Do I need to start it? Okay, it's rolling. Okay. That's all right. Okay. All right, very good. Let's begin with prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we are grateful for the Sabbath day. We thank you for the opportunity to look into the past and see your providential hand in history, and especially in our own history. We thank you, Lord, for the church. Great love for her and the centrality of the church in studying the past. We thank you, Lord, for this opportunity to speak freedom and liberty on the nation in which you've placed us. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. I got to attend a Bible conference this past week down in Greenville, South Carolina. It was really a wonderful experience to go over the year. And it was on the attributes of God and their kind of practical application for us. It was a tremendous series of sermons. And I always meet a few new people each time. And I met somebody who, a church that we had been a part of in Richmond years ago, just as we were in the process of leaving and moving to another location, a new family had come into the church, and I had just met them there at the church, and then we moved, and they stayed, and they're still there. And he comes to this conference, and I got to spend some time with him. I'd met him years and years ago, hadn't seen him since. And he asked me where I attended worship, and I told him. And he says, is Paul Martin there? And I said, yes, he is. And he said, you tell him I said hi. And I said, I'll do that. We love Paul Martin. He said, yeah. Because he only has one glaring weakness. He needs to learn something about the Psalms. I said, well, it's less glaring than you might think. I thought that was a funny joke. He's our local salter. I'd like to read the summary about the 1650s. We talked about last week with the rule of Cromwell in England and over Scotland. And here is here's a summary of that period that I like. We know that the king returned in 1660. What's it called? The what? The Restoration. Brilliant. That's exactly right. The Restoration. At the king's return, every single parish in Scotland had a minister. Every village had a school. Every family, almost, had a Bible. Yea, in most of the country, all the children of age could read the scriptures. Every minister was obliged to preach three times a week, to lecture and catechize once, besides other private duties wherein they abounded. None of them might be scandalous in their conversation or negligent in their office, so long as a presbytery stood. And among them were many holy in conversation and eminent in gifts. In many places the Spirit seemed to be poured out with the word, both by the multitude of sincere converts and also by the common work of reformation upon many. There were no fewer than 60 aged people, men and women, who went to school that even they might be able to read the scriptures with their own eyes. I have lived in many a parish where I've never heard an oath, and you might have to ride many miles before you heard any. Also, you could not for a great part of the country have lodged in a family where the Lord was not worshipped by reading, singing, and public prayer. Nobody complained more of our church government than our taverners, who ordinary lamentation was, quote, their trade was broke, people were become so sober. And the man who, more than any other, helped to secure for the land this Sabbatism of godliness was misunderstood, resisted, and denounced. It is one of those pitiful and poignant contradictions of which history provides many an example. Speaking of Cromwell, and Cromwell's rule in Scotland. Nobody was more vilified in Scotland than him, yet he's the one that was responsible for the presbyteries, the churches, and the pastors to see true biblical Christianity flourish for an entire decade, from 1650 to 1660 in Scotland. It was an absolutely remarkable time. And that's the decade of the, that's the chapter I haven't written in my biography of James Guthrie. It's the 1650s I haven't written about yet. Yet it is the crucial time in the life of Guthrie, who was, as we mentioned before, was the first Covenanter martyr along with Argyle. And with that in mind, I want to read to you his last words. It's interesting that when they executed these guys, they often gave them the opportunity to speak on the day of their death, and they'd be taken to be hanged or to be beheaded. Preachers would preach a sermon crowd because they were attended by thousands. It was somebody famous. Thousands of people would come to the execution to hear what that person had to say. And oftentimes they were allowed to speak or to preach on their just before their death.
Where did it start? Like, why would they allow it?
I don't think that that was the case in England, mostly, but in Scotland it was, and I don't know exactly why, because sometimes they didn't permit it. Sometimes they were given specific instructions, the executioners were given specific instructions, don't let this person say anything, and they would do things to make it as unpleasant as they could. But in the case of James Guthrie, although they at first made it difficult for him, he had gout or some other painful problem, physical problem, and it was difficult for him to walk. And anyway, they enabled him to at least get to the place where he's shortly to be executed. On the ladder, climbing the scaffold, he climbed partway up. And he was a short man. Remember, he's the little man who couldn't bow. He got halfway up where he could see out over the throng of people that came to his execution. And he stopped and he preached a sermon. He said this. I thought it's an example of a Covenanter preacher going to his death. And before he did, his family was allowed to visit him in prison. And the prison that he was in is in the kind of in the dungeons of Edinburgh Castle. So you can actually go there and go down in the dungeons, and you can see the very room where, in this case, James Guthrie was incarcerated. And other famous preachers and other gross malefactors who think that they can't stay ahead of the church. And his family came to see him, and he had a young son and a young daughter, and he took his young son on his lap. And among his last words, this was the day before he was executed, he told his son that he said, Willie, they're going to take your father and But there's no greater, no more worthy a cause than the cause of Christ. And there's no greater calling than the preaching of the gospel. And he said that they're going to, after I'm hanged, they will cut my head off, and they will post it on a wall someplace public. And he said, don't ever be ashamed because you see your father's head on a wall. He said, for he died for the covenant and the testimony of Christ. And I would think I would hate to say that to my son. I have to be able to say those words the day before being executed, but that's what he said to him. And such was the case in the years following, because that's exactly what happened. He would point up on the wall and say, that's my pa's head. And as he grew, he was converted, and he was going to become a preacher as well. The young Guthrie lad, the same week he was ordained to gospel ministry, he died of some disease, cholera or something. So he never actually got to the pulpit, but he was where he was headed his whole life. Well, when Guthrie is on the ladder, he says this: I take God's cord upon my soul. I would not exchange this scaffold with the palace and mitre of the greatest prelate in Britain. It's recorded that the day prior to his execution, he was offered the opportunity if he would sign the documents recognizing the king as the head of the church, that even a bishop's mitre might be in his future. He was given an offer because he was such a brilliant man, such a great leader, that he could be made a bishop in the Anglican Church if he would but deny the covenant and recognize the king. And of course he didn't, but he said, I would not exchange this scaffold with the palace and mitre of the greatest prelate in Britain. Blessed be God who has shown mercy to me, such a wretch, and has revealed his Son in me, and made me a minister of the everlasting gospel, and that he hath deigned in the midst of much contradiction from Satan and the world to seal my ministry upon the hearts of not a few of his people. Jesus Christ is my life and my light, my righteousness, my strength, and my salvation, and all my desire. Him, I do with all the strength of my soul commend to you. Bless him, O my soul, from henceforth even forevermore. Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation. That is in a very fine book by Jock Purvis called Fair Sunshine, which is a book that's still in print, published by Banner of Truth. But the last words of James Guthrie, recorded very carefully, on the scaffold by a young man named, I think it's William Trail. Is it William Trail, whose works have been published? He was 18 years old, and he asked to be able to stand on the scaffold next to James Guthrie, and they let him do it. And he recorded the last words, and they're published, later published by Jock Purvis in the 20th century. And so ended the life of Guthrie. And he was there because of one particular nobleman who hated Guthrie, because Guthrie had announced his excommunication. There was a nobleman who was excommunicated by the church, by the General Assembly of the church, but everybody was too afraid to pronounce it, and they asked Guthrie to do it in his church on a Sunday morning. And he was reluctant. He didn't know what to do. He knew there'd be retribution. was, Duke of Hamilton, I can't remember his name. Anyway, he didn't know exactly what to do when he got up that Sunday morning, and part of his duty in the worship service was to pronounce the excommunication of this Lord. And his wife said, James, God has called you to the ministry and has given you leadership in the presbytery, and you have, and they have asked you to do this. What's the right thing to do? And he went through with the excommunication and the announcement of it. And anyway, that man was the one who secured his execution on behalf of the king. The king had given him that authority. It's interesting that the king, to be fair to King Charles II, when he asked how things were in Scotland, he said, Argyll has been executed, and Guthrie, but Warriston has escaped. Warriston has escaped, and there was somebody else that the king had ordered executed that the parliament had given a pardon to. And he said, ah, if I'd have known that parliament was going to pardon so-and-so, he said, I wouldn't have executed Guthrie. So allegedly, he said that. But we don't, and we don't know for sure what in all the dynamics behind all of that and the politics that were in place at the time. In any case, James Guthrie was executed, and his head was stuck on the Netherbow port, and with a message posted on the wall. Netherbow port isn't there today, but the location of it has a big plaque, and says this was the location of the Netherbow port, and you can see drawings of what it looked like. It was one of the gates that you entered into through the wall surrounding Edinburgh, and it's how you came into the city, and that was one of the ports that you could come into the city. And they used the Netherbow as a place to put hardened criminals and murderers who were executed, and also preachers and others, Covenanters, and they would stick their heads on the Netherbow port, and they with a message underneath, and the message this is what happens to those who deny the sovereignty of the king over the church, and anyone who removes this is subject to the same treatment. So if someone would have tried to undo what was done by taking down this person's head, they themselves, if were caught, would be executed. And so his head was there for 30 years, and a college student climbed up and removed it and went and buried it at Greyfriars. And that college student eventually became the pastor of the church in Stirling that James Guthrie had been pastor of. The man who very reverently, as a college student, disobeyed the government and buried James Guthrie. His body had already been buried in Greyfriars. In fact, when Covenanters were executed, there were ladies in Edinburgh that would take charge of the bodies and would take them down to a little chapel on a side street, and there they would clean the bodies and prepare them for burial and take them up and bury them secretly at night in Greyfriars Kirkyard.
I have a question. How does the head stay intact for 30 years?
Well, eventually it's just a skull. And yeah,
okay.
Eventually. Anyway, the execution of those four or five men and all the regicides in England, Charles hoped that would put an end to any kind of resistance to the Anglican Church, Church of England, taking over the Presbyterian Church. Bishops were appointed all across Scotland. And as I mentioned last week, the Act Recessory was passed, which canceled all legislation in Scotland from the previous 20 years. All that legislation was null and void, and the new order of things was installed by the Restoration government. The bishops were restored in 1662, restored to all their previous authoritarian power. And a document was sent around to be signed by all the nobles and all the preachers, in which they were to say, they were to sign, "I do sincerely affirm and declare that I judge it unlawful for subject under the pretext of reformation or any other pretext whatsoever to enter into leagues and covenants or to take up arms against the king or those commissioned by him, and all those gatherings," that is church services, "petitions, etc., that were used in the beginning and carry on of the late troubles were unlawful and seditious." In other words, any appeal to the king's mercy, anything like that, is treasonous, and particularly that these oaths, whereof the one was commonly called the National Covenant, were and are in themselves unlawful oaths, and that there lieth no obligation upon me or upon any of the subjects from the said oaths to endeavor any alteration of the government of church or state as it is now established by the laws of the kingdom. So Charles hoped that that would take care of the problem. Well, it did not take care of the problem. It exacerbated the problem. They ended up ejecting 400 pastors from their pulpits, and people began meeting in illegal meetings all over Scotland. And the government came down very hard in persecution of the field meetings, or they were called conventicles. Any meeting that was declared by the government as illegal as is called a conventicle.
Bill, the Robert Trail that took down Guthrie's words.
Yes.
Was he one of those pastors that got ejected?
Robert Trail Sr. The 18-year-old Robert Trail that was on the scaffold with Guthrie. His father was Robert Trail Sr., and his father is one of the ones who was ejected and goes to the continent, goes to the Netherlands, leaves Scotland. And then Robert Trail Jr. is going to become ordained and become a preacher, and his sermons are the ones that are going to be both recorded and published, and are wonderful sermons.
The Banner of Truth.
Banner of Truth edition is the one that, the current one. So that was the young man that was there. And there's a, well, this will come a little bit later. Another trail story to go with that, actually. It's kind of interesting. There are certain names that, of leaders of combat teams that went around searching for Covenanters, and certain men who became notorious for killing and when their names were mentioned in years gone by, when their names were mentioned, people would like, you're probably familiar with in the Bible with the scoundrel in the Old Testament by the name of Haman, who was given the task of rounding up the Jews. And he was part of this conspiracy against God's people. And eventually he ends up getting hanged, right? He gets it in the end. And there's an old Jewish tradition that whenever Haman's name is mentioned, people hiss. The Jews would hiss and they'd spit whenever they heard Haman's name. He was so accursed. Well, there are several characters like that. One named Claverhouse and another one, James Turner. These were soldiers that were particularly cruel against the Covenanters. And they were Scottish, of course. No battle was ever fought in Scotland that didn't have Scots on both sides. That includes all of the invasions by the French or by the English. There are always Scots on the side of the enemy. There are always Scots on both sides of every fight. And when it came time, when it came to Charles II taking over Scotland from the Cromwells, his henchmen were all Scots who wanted favor with the king, who wanted castles, who wanted lands, and the king would grant them. For, you know, based on how many Covenanters they could round up and throw in prison or could bring to execution or what have you. And James Turner is one of those. And his soldiers were all Highland thugs. The Highlands were still predominantly Roman Catholic or Anglican. The Reformation in certain areas of the Highlands never succeeded. And there were certain clans that remained Catholic to the bitter end. And that the most famous of which are the MacDonalds. MacDonalds, very few MacDonalds were ever converted or became Presbyterian. They remained bitter enemies of any of the clans that became Reformed, which some of them did, like the Campbells. So the Campbells were an example of Presbyterian Highlanders, and their bitterest foes were the MacDonalds, who still had allegiance to the Pope and to the Catholic Church. And so those are two. Even today, this is kind of funny, when they have Highland Games in the United States and all the clans have their own tents. I don't know if any of you have been to Highland Games, but all the different clans, because America is made up of Scottish people and Germans, basically, the vast majority. That's not going to be the case in 10 years, but just historically, Americans were either German or Scottish or English for the most part. In any case, there are Highland Games that are held around the United States, and the clans have their American representatives there, and they have their own booth, and they try to sign people up to join that particular Scottish clan if you have Scottish ancestry, etc. Well, when they have these Highland Games, they have to put the Campbells at one end and the MacDonalds at the other. Because if they end up side by side or within visual distance, a fight is going to break out. And there's a very long history of that, and it's kind of comical, but they have to do that even at the Highland Games in America. I've seen it. You know, they're at the opposite poles. And everybody else was kind of in between, but those were the two most radical ends of Presbyterians and Catholics clans. But James Turner and other miscreants serving the king would go to the MacDonald clan and would recruit these teams of Highland thugs to use against the Covenanters. And one of the ways in which they tried to completely eradicate the Covenanters, or at least to keep them down and keep them from joining together in worship at conventicles, is they would take Highlanders and put them in the homes of the Covenanters. And these Highland thugs were as evil as you could conceive. I mean, these are people that made a living stealing cattle and killing their neighbors. And they would be brought down and put in the homes of godly people to try and destroy covenanting families, covenanter families, and such. And there are a lot of wicked stories that go along with all of that. During the time between 1662 and 1688, when this all came to an end, the persecution of the Covenanters, or generally came to an end in 1688. Between that time is persecution. There are 20 years of very hard persecution of the Covenanters. Well, during that time, there are several pitched battles that take place. And that's why one reason the Covenanters are so hated. There are a bunch of reasons, but one of the reasons was that they took up arms to defend themselves from the persecution. And there are people who say they had no right to do that. There are Christians who say they should just have allowed themselves to be slaughtered. That's what Christ wants to happen, you know. That's not the way the Scots look at it necessarily, especially the Covenanters. And one of the great battles that was fought occurred because of an incident in a village in the south of Scotland where several strapping young teenage Covenanters saw some soldiers picking on an elderly man, an 80-year-old Covenanter man, and the soldiers were kicking him and pounding on him, and they were going to kill him because they said that he had attended a conventicle. He had attended the preaching, field preaching, in the previous Sunday, and they had the right to kill him. And they accused him of that, and they were beating on him, and these teenagers intervened. And in the scuffle that ensued, one of the soldiers got himself very seriously killed by these boys who were not going to allow this elderly man to be beaten up. Well, the result was that the Covenanters took the opportunity to write up a petition to appeal to Parliament to at least follow the English legal system and give a fair trial of peers for people who were being accosted and accused of crimes, that at least they should be tried in a court and it should be legal. So they drew up a petition and they were carrying it to Edinburgh. And as they were going there to present this petition, more and more Covenanters joined in this group because they knew that they would be attacked and maybe killed for even thinking of presenting a petition, because presenting a petition was made illegal too, which was illegal for the government to make that particular petition based on English law. In any case, by the time they got outside of Edinburgh, they had some 800 men with them who brought their farm implements with them to defend themselves. A few of them had guns, a few of them had swords, not many. Most of them just had things around the farm, sickles and hammers and things like that. But they were considered weapons, and it's like trying to get on an airplane today. You know, anything that you have that's been banned is considered a weapon. And the government sent an army to stop them. And a pitched battle was fought at a place called Rulian Green, in the Pentland Hills outside of Edinburgh. And the Covenanters, now called the Covenanter Army, the rebels, the revolutionaries who wanted to overthrow the king, were attacked by a Scottish-English army, and they were wiped out. And they were sorely defeated and scattered. And then over the next months, they were rounded up and tortured to find out the names of every single person that had been with this group that was going to Edinburgh. And they had execution after execution. A number of them were enslaved and shipped to the colonies. And the Battle of Rulian Green was considered a revolutionary act by the Scottish Covenanters. Yes, like, except they remembered to bring weapons with them. The Covenanters didn't go unarmed. You know, the Great Revolution, the attempt to overthrow the U.S. government, everybody forgot to bring weapons. But the Scots carried weapons to protect themselves. In any case, they were dispersed, they were defeated, and many of them were killed. And there are just 100 different stories about the tracking down of the Covenanters after Rulian Green. And then, a couple years later, the same thing happened again. the Covenanters actually formed, self-consciously formed an army to defend themselves against the attacks of the king's troops who were trying to prevent them from worshiping. And that's called the Battle of Bothwell Bridge. It occurred just outside of Bothwell Castle, which unfortunately is closed when we're going to be there in a couple months. But the bridge is open, the battle, and there's just a plaque there now commemorating the battle of, what's called the Battle of Bothwell Bridge. And the Covenanters were disorganized, their leadership was poor, and while they gave a good account of themselves in the battle on the bridge, they killed any number of the king's troops in the fight. They were defeated and again dispersed, and this time the retribution was absolutely ferocious. And hundreds of them were exiled, and another several hundreds were executed for treason and for rebellion against the crown. And by strict definition, it certainly qualifies, although from their perspective, they were merely setting out to defend their families and themselves from destruction. Because they were worshiping illegally, not according to government regulations. None of them wore a mask. We'll fast forward through one other incident, Battle of Rulian Green and Battle of Bothwell Bridge, both occurred in the between 1662 and 1688. And one other incident that brought retribution around 1670. One of the main Covenanters prior to the coming of Charles II was a preacher named James Sharp. And he had been a classmate of James Guthrie, as a matter of fact, at St. Andrews. And James Sharp had become one of the most prominent preachers in Scotland and one of the primary Covenanters. But in reality, James Sharp was an absolute traitor to the Covenanters, and he was on the king's side all along. And he acted kind of like a secret agent, feeding information to the royal party all through those years. And when Charles II took the throne, he made James Sharp one of the Episcopal bishops of Scotland. So he had been an arch Covenanter, but not really. He had been a phony all along. But he was a brilliant guy, and an excellent preacher, and a leader of the Covenanters. But in reality, he was a king's man all the way and all along. And he got himself assassinated. He was waylaid by a bunch of Covenanters on his way to St. Andrews, and he was hacked to death in front of his family. And the response to that, as you might well imagine, was also ferocious. They never did actually catch all the assassins of James Sharp. But if you read the story of the Covenanters and the story of these periods, you're going to feel bad about the way they did it, but not necessarily that James Sharp was taken off the board, because his actions had resulted in the death of quite a few Covenanters. So John Graham of Claverhouse and James Turner were the two probably worst of the Covenanter hunters of the period. And then the last, I think I already mentioned the two Margarets a few weeks back, a couple of the women martyrs of the period. And the other, the last Covenanter to be kind of formally executed by the government was a man named James Renwick. And I'll say a few things about James. He was actually born during this period, and as he came of age, during these years, he wanted to follow in the footsteps of one pastor in particular, Richard Cameron, and he's another whole interesting story too, a very admirable character in many ways. But James Renick wanted to become a pastor, and of course he couldn't become a pastor in the Church of Scotland because Church of Scotland was in the hands of the Anglican Church and of the King, and he himself would not be allowed to go to seminary and become a covenanter preacher, although several men successfully did that anyway. But Renick was a little more radical than some of the other students in the seminaries who secretly wanted to join the covenanters, who were bolder than the rest and more aggressive than the rest. And so he traveled to the Netherlands, where there was, you might say, a Presbyterian exile. And there he received both training and he was given the right to preach. He was commissioned as a preacher, and he returned to Scotland as such and began preaching in the fields. But so he was considered a rogue preacher. Now, one of the problems the Covenanters faced was that the government refused to recognize baptisms by Covenanter preachers, marriages. Every Presbyterian young couple that wanted to be married had to be married in the church building with the Anglican preacher in the pulpit. They were not allowed, because of the 400 ministers being thrown from their pulpits, they could no longer conduct any service at all for the people, including marriages and baptisms. And so for 20 some years, marriages were done in secret in the fields, but never recognized as legal by the government. And their children that came out of those unions were not considered legitimate. And so there's an entire generation of covenanter families who weren't even considered as legitimate children and legally married people by the government. And so when people like James Renick were authorized to preach by this sort of, I call it a Presbyterian exile in the Netherlands, he wasn't recognized by the government, and a lot of preachers were absolutely cowed by this. I mean, they performed no baptisms. They might attend a field meeting, or they might even preach in a field meeting, but they wouldn't conduct marriages because they were afraid of the retribution of the government that didn't approve. And so when someone like James Renick came along, and he's a newly minted second lieutenant, you know, of the Covenanters as a preacher, he first thing he does is he goes into an area and says, bring your children for baptism. And he only was able to serve for a year or two before he was captured and executed as the last Covenanter to die for the covenants. And it's estimated he baptized over 600 children in the course of his just few year ministry. And he also married quite a few of them. Renick slipped back into Scotland and preached in the conventicles around Lanarkshire, which was a hotbed of Covenanter resistance. Historians believe that he baptized more than 600 children. A price was put on his head of 5,000 merks, which was the Scottish monetary system. And Renick and some 200 followers issued a declaration And they posted it in the town of Sanquhar, where the Cameronians had done the same thing, declaring that the King of England was illegitimate, that he was no king, that the very recognition of, in this case, James II as King of England was false because he was Roman Catholic. And by the laws of England, no Roman Catholic could serve as King of England. And so Renwick and his followers declared the king illegitimate. Now, kings don't like that. And these are already Covenanters. And so there's a great hue and cry to track down James Renwick as a rebel and as a revolutionary seeking to overthrow the monarchy of England. And as I said, they eventually are going to catch him. In February of 1688, he'd been preaching in several homes in Edinburgh. And that's no place to be for a Covenanter preacher in Edinburgh. But it is a big city, and they get away with quite a bit there that they don't necessarily get away with in other places. But someone turned him in, which is typically what happened to Covenanter preachers that got caught, is they were turned in by members of their congregation, or people not sympathetic to the Covenanters. And that's what happened to him. And he was tried, and he was convicted. And he was taken to the scaffold and hanged for the sake of the divine right of Christ over his church. And there's a nice biography of him entitled Preacher to the Remnant, the Story of James Renwick, by Morris Grant of the Scottish Reformation Society. And he's written biographies of Renwick and Richard Cameron. And we really don't have time to investigate. But if you're interested in learning more about these, our forebears of Scotland, I can recommend all sorts of books that are in print that sort of detail the stories of the Covenanters. Now, how do we get from there, from the Covenanters of Scotland, and the creation and flowering of the Presbyterian Church over several centuries from John Knox forward to today, to the Presbyterian Church as we know it in America today? In fact, there are, I guess I'll have to count up the number of Presbyterian denominations there are. I used to quip that all Baptist churches should be called Paramecium Baptist Church, because they were always dividing, simple cell division, and multiplying all across the landscape over the minutest of reasons. But Presbyterians have not been slack in dividing and creating new Presbyterian denominations in America. And that tree has many branches, and I'm going to try and simplify it, or probably we'll end up making it more complex, explaining how Presbyterianism took hold in America, which it did. And I want to really begin that story with a young man by the name of Francis McKemy. And keep an eye on the time for me. I don't have
It's 11
o'clock. Oh, wow, I got to quit. So we'll start with Francis McKemy next week, who organizes the first presbytery in America, and how he got here during the times of the Covenanters. And that's where we'll start next week. Thanks.
Bill, as we're talking,
And if you're following this, then let me just say I'm going to create something.
Oh, I'm not really. Just
because I saw the names, I'm kind of.
I just picked a couple quotes out of there. That's all. I'm not following it. Yeah, I'm not really following it as the outline, but
yeah, I just put some notes here and there.
There's some good quotes in there.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you, Bill.
Yeah.
You're gonna give us a little synopsis between the first revolution and what happened.
Yeah. Uh huh. Yeah. Yeah. I'll put it all in the political context there too, and talk about Ireland. I've got a lot I have to say about Ireland because most of the Scots that came to America came by way of Ireland first. So it was really a
Scotch-Irish.
It really wasn't a Scottish immigration per se. It was. I'm going to try and. Oh yeah, I'll try and explain the difference between Scots and.